solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
You know, I think what I can say is in my own sort of journey through it is, it just opened up the idea for me that it's not a dress rehearsal. It's going to death, that is going to happen pretty soon. You know, certainly I'm more than halfway done. I'm probably three quarters of the way done. And it just sort of emphasizes that you don't have forever to ignore death. And in the book, I actually call that transience aversion. It's the idea that we, as a society, I think, and I will say in the US society more than others, I believe, we're really afraid of talking about death. We're really afraid of bringing death to the forefront. We kind of like act like it's a dirty topic, like defecating, or like, you know, it's one of those things that everybody has to do, but we don't say much about it because it makes us like the other animals. And we like to think we're a very special animal, I think. And I think that is a bit of a curse. And for me, I'll just say for me, getting rid of that transience aversion and just acknowledging that I won't be here much longer was so liberating and it was so energizing. And for me, that was quite a discovery. You know, that was not something I was expecting.
Welcome to the 75th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. And this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and other leading professionals to decode insights around leadership, transitions, and careers. When I'm not podcasting, I'm working with leaders as a trusted sounding board, helping them and organizations play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. It's playtopotential.com. We now have an exciting update to the podcast. Several of our listeners have told us that we should be sharing some of the nuggets from the archives. Given we've been doing this for close to 5 years and we have 750 odd nuggets in the library and we continue to build on it. And we've started doing that through WhatsApp, where we share a couple of nuggets a week, one in the middle of the week and one over the weekend. If you wish to receive these, do make a note of the number +91 85914 52129. Add that number to your contacts and send us a WhatsApp message saying interested. We will add you to the list. I repeat the number +91 85914 52129. My guest this time is Dan Cable, Professor of Organizational Behavior at London Business School. He's the author of the book Exceptional, Build Your Personal Highlight Reel and Unlock Your Potential. Dan says that just like we see highlights of sports games that provide us the best moments from the matches, there's an opportunity for each one of us to construct, with the help of others, a personal highlights reel. And that could help each one of us unlock our unique potential. His research is smack in the sweet spot of the kinds of things we are curious about at the podcast. Before diving into his work, we spoke about how he used a cancer diagnosis and a near brush with death to prioritize what mattered to him and move forward in his life. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Professor Dan Cable. Dan, excited to have you at the Play to Potential podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks a lot for having me. This will be fun.
Wonderful. And maybe just to kick things off, where are you today and how's your day been so far?
I'm here in London. I'd say pretty good. I mean, it's sunny. I'm looking outside right now and I'm seeing blue sky. So I guess I'm smiling.
That's wonderful. We could do with a little bit of cheer in these times. So it's great to hear that. Dan, also excited to talk to an LBS professor, having spent some time a decade plus back at London Business School. This podcast, in a way, I talk to people about their journeys. And the three, let's say, words I'm sort of loyal to in the podcast are leadership, transitions, and careers. And when I came across this, your book, Exceptional, I was truly intrigued because, in a way, especially when I'm dealing with people at a transition point, the key question is, how do we really take stock of their strengths and help them navigate and create possibilities for the future? But before we dive into the book, Dan, I'd love to know a little bit about your journey. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, your journey and, you know, what you do at LBS and maybe a little bit of arc of your curiosity that led you to the book Exceptional?
Yeah, absolutely. The two major things in terms of my journey were having a family that didn't go to university, meaning my mom, dad, but also my older brother and uncles. Nobody went. And I got a chance to go. And, you know, it's funny. I probably was not even there a year when I pretty much knew I wanted to be a professor. So like step one in my journey was at an age, you know, age 18, 19 years old, just kind of falling for science and learning and teaching. So that's like, I think that's like step one for me. Uh-huh. And then it took a long time, obviously, to get my degree and then get a master's and get a PhD, blah, 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 blah. But then I did get a job as a management professor down at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia. And then some things happened in between there and the sort of next big thing for me. But the next huge thing, I actually wrote about it in the book quite a bit, was when I got cancer. I got a stage 4 lymphoma, and that woke me up. And, you know, it didn't kill me. So again, it made me stronger. I don't know. But I would say that actually was the second most important thing in a way, because it helped me reconfigure my world. You know, that's when I moved to London. But more importantly, that's when I started, I might say, playing to my own strengths. And that might be something we talk about, because that sounds like it is aligned with what you're trying to deliver readers. So I could say anything else. I don't want to go on and on, but I mean, those are two really deep pieces of information about my trajectory.
Absolutely. And Dan, if I talk about my journey, 2008, my father was diagnosed with late stage cancer when I was in the US. And in a way, those 6 months dealing with his terminal cancer, in his case, he passed away in a few months, really changed a lot of things for me. Mm-hmm. Can you take us back to that moment when you got that diagnosis of stage 4 cancer and maybe walk us through that passage of play and how that changed things for you?
Yeah. You know, what's so interesting is there's probably really pretty ways to say this, but the way it felt to me was death as an idea stopped being an idea and started being something that would affect me. And that was profound. I almost can't say how profound it was, because it went from being like a concept that was going to happen to other people to something that might affect me in the next 3 to 5 months. And boy, that really changed the nature of the conversation in my brain. And I could say in a good way, I never recovered from that, and I never want to. You know, it's almost like it became much more critical to align like what made me happy and what made me joyful and what felt purposeful. That became much more important to align that now. For example, one tiny example, this would be, I always knew I wanted to live outside the US, but nobody in my family even had passports. You know, we were just like lower middle class, you know, nobody even thought about leaving the country. And I knew I wanted to, but I just never did. And so pretty much, if you take it forward 6 months, as soon as the doctor said all clear, I started trying to move to England. So it just kind of precipitated more purposeful living, I would say.
Got it. And maybe picking up from that phase of life, Dan, to today, if you could talk a little bit about what you've been curious about and maybe give us a little bit of a context to why you wrote the book.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that's a good one. I'll take one step back and then I'll move us forward. when I was at the University of North Carolina, and I was there about 13 years, I was fairly skeptical about the field called positive psychology. I was trained as an industrial psychologist, which was considerably more, I wouldn't say cynical, but I would say practical. That's the best word. Very practical. Like, how do you hire the best people? And how do you use selection testing? How do you do validation of hiring tools? You know, quite practical, businessy kind of things. Right. And then positive psychology put its head up. It just seemed a little too good to be true. You know, it just seemed, if I'm honest, it seemed a little mamby-pamby, kind of like, oh, come on, can't be that simple. And so I kind of didn't give it the time of day. And something that happened was after the cancer, I started putting a lot more emphasis on it and started thinking harder about, like, what if it were true? And what if my job could entail giving people more life? I mean, I think that's way too broad and way too sort of generous, but like just the idea of my job as a professor being a platform for putting more living into life. And it was just an idea that I really wanted to pursue. Anyway, long story short is I really dedicated myself to this concept of best self. And that included like starting a little business, the create these reports about people at their best. And I skewed my teaching toward the science of positive psychology and kind of taking it as a science and not sort of something to dismiss. And so I would say, since about 2010, positive psychology in general, but also best self activation as a sort of specific piece of that, and even more specific is these highlight reels that you mentioned. That's a specific way to activate your best self. I would say that that stream of research and science has kind of consumed me. And it's, I got to tell you, Deepak, it's just now that I'm starting to get that work published in the best journals. You know, it took a long time. Like what wasn't very hard was to start doing research on how a company could use best self-activation in the context of socializing new hires. I published something back in like 2013 on that. And it also wasn't too hard to publish something on how if you allow people to create their job titles around their strengths, you could get more out of people. And that also was published. But the most recent things that are just getting accepted now are the ones showing that the highlight reel improves team performance and improves each employee's ability to bring their best self to the team.
Fascinating. And if I may take you back, actually, Dan, you know, one of the earlier guests of the podcast was a gentleman called Bruce Feiler, mm-hmm. who studied transitions across thousands of people. And he uses the term life quakes, right, to talk about how people, you know, encounter these situations and how we sort of use that as an opportunity to make meaning. Mm-hmm. Having, with the wisdom of hindsight, you know, if you go back to your days of making meaning out of being diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and recovering from it. What's the advice you would give for people who deal with these life quakes, mm-hmm. having lived through a similar experience? What's something that you sort of have learned with the benefit of hindsight?
Right. Well, the first thing I would say, which is the most honest thing, is I think these topics are so idiosyncratic that anything that I would say would probably be taken with a grain of salt, because I just think that it can really come off as, I'd say, disingenuous in a way to think that one person could give somebody else advice on this stuff. Here's another way of saying it. I, in my own life, have realized some post-traumatic growth, meaning I was fortunate enough through lots of different reasons that when I came out of this thing, not dead, I was able to convert that suffering and that deep existential angst. Somehow I was able to convert that into a more meaningful existence with much greater joy, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure you've heard the story 100 times, but you know, maybe what we haven't heard is the 1,000 times when people aren't able to do that, you know, where, for example, they end up suffering in a way physically where they just weren't able to rebound and that's always gotten them down from then on. Or maybe it took away their faith in a religion, you know, that it took away their faith that a God would do this to them, you know. So I would never want to act like, oh yeah, just do these three steps.
Sure.
But that said, I think that what I can say is in my own sort of journey through it is, it just opened up the idea for me that it's not a dress rehearsal. It's going to death. That is going to happen pretty soon. You know, certainly I'm more than halfway done. I'm probably three quarters of the way done. And it just sort of emphasizes that you don't have forever to ignore death. And in the book, I actually call that transience aversion. It's the idea that we, as a society, I think, and I will say in the US society more than others, I believe, we're really afraid of talking about death. We're really afraid of bringing death to the forefront. We kind of like act like it's a dirty topic, like defecating, or like, you know, it's one of those things that everybody has to do, but we don't say much about it because it makes us like the other animals. And we like to think we're a very special animal, I think. And I think that is a bit of a curse. And for me, I'll just say, getting rid of that transience aversion and just acknowledging that I won't be here much longer was so liberating and it was so energizing. And for me, that was quite a discovery. You know, that was not something I was expecting.
Got it. And back to your work, Dan, in the context of the book Exceptional, maybe if I could ask a provocative question, right? Sure. I think there's a lot being said about build on your strengths, right? Don't oversweat the weakness, but double down on your strengths. In what ways is your work, talk to us about the nuance that you're bringing to the discussion here.
Sure. The first thing I'd like to say, just to kind of put it out there, is it still does mostly have to do with playing to your strengths and doubling down on your strengths. I mean, I'm going to say some things that that I do think add quite a bit, but there's nothing really new under the sun. And I would say that it plays on that theme pretty much primarily, you know, if I'm honest. One of the biggest differences, and perhaps the biggest difference, is how you learn about your strengths has been a real interesting journey for me. I think that a lot of people think they know their strengths, but my research suggests that we often don't. That we have ideas about what we think we're best at, but a lot of times we forget that our strengths aren't what we're best at. It's more the intersection of what we're good at doing and what we love doing. But it also has a real important element of how we make an impact. And so if you start to think about that as a Venn diagram, you might know what you're good at, you might know what you like, but oftentimes we don't know what affects other people the most. You could call that your impact, or you could call that kind of like, you could call it your purpose, you know, like what you're sort of doing for the world and for other people. And one thing that we've been finding is self-reflection often doesn't yield that. So what we're doing, and by the way, so I didn't invent any of this, but at the University of Michigan, there were some I would call them my heroes, frankly, but these would be people like Dutton. And this would be like Laura Morgan Roberts, and this would be like Gretchen Spreitzer, Bob Quinn. These people, you know, this is 15 years ago, they started writing in an abstract, conceptual way about how, if you want to know your impact, you should ask the people that you impact. And that concept of a reflection of your best self was really intriguing to me 15 years ago, but they and many people in the field didn't do empirical research on that. And so that's actually that's the sort of bucket that I picked up and ran with, is we really should work on that. You know, we really should understand if that's even true. And so anyway, over the last 10 years, I feel like I've learned a lot about how surprised people are when they get one of these highlights reels. And basically what that is, it is memories and stories from family, from friends, from colleagues, from mentors. It's people that have watched you over the years, even over the decades, And then they write a story that is their memory of a time you've done something exceptional. That's the name of the book. That's why that book is called Exceptional. It's there are times when you've had an extraordinary impact, and here's my memory of you doing that. And I just can't tell you, number one, how powerful and emotional that is to read it from other people as opposed to just self-reflecting. So that's one thing. I think a second thing I'd put out there is just the vast amount of new insights that you can get, because a lot of things that people remember for 15 years, 20 years, and they write down in a lot of detail, you might not even think of as a big deal. You might think, oh, no, that's just easy. That's what anybody would do. And if you have 7, 8, 9 people writing different stories, but around that same theme, but you yourself just don't think that's a big deal, that highlight reel starts to unveil ways of you becoming exceptional. And I call them high leverage moves. It's just a way that you can do a little more in an area and create a much bigger impact, but you wouldn't do it because you kind of downplay it. You think anybody would do it.
Got it. And maybe a couple of questions just to understand this a little better, Dan. One is, are we asking the question, when have I been exceptional? Or are we asking the question, when have I done something exceptional to you, something that made a difference to you? That's sort of right. Question number one. And second is, how do we think about who to ask? How narrow or how wide should the catchment radius be?
Yeah, let's start with the second one. So in terms of who, I just try to get people to go with as many people as they can who know them quite well. So usually I recommend one or two people you've met in the last couple of years, you know, who know that newish version of you. So often that's work colleagues and new friends. Then I ask for people that have known you a long time. So this is going back perhaps into childhood. In my own, for example, I had a high school buddy. I had a junior high school buddy. I obviously had a parent. I had people from university. So, you know, that would be 18 to 22. So, and then I had a mentor. So an old, professor, but somebody that kind of helped me through my career. So diversity of people. So work, non-work, family, non-family, that sort of thing. And newer people that just have known you a little while and people that have known you a long while. That's the sort of, you really can't go wrong. To be honest, you can't go, you're not going to get that wrong other than asking too few people.
Fascinating.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I've come to realize that we sometimes don't appreciate enough how we come across to the people around us and how we touch their lives. The best way to get to that is to ask them. I also realize that we cannot meditate our way out of this by going to a Vipassana camp or something like that. The vectors of internal and external self-awareness are often orthogonal. One of my earlier guests, Tasha Urich, an expert in the area of self-awareness, speaks about this notion.
Self-awareness is made up of two types of self-knowledge. The first is something we named internal self-awareness, which is essentially knowing who we are on the inside. What do we value? What are we passionate about? What are our aspirations? What are the patterns of behavior that we exhibit across situations? But equally important is something called external self-awareness. And in a nutshell, what that means is knowing how other people see us. And what was fascinating, at least to me in our research, was that we found that those two types of self-knowledge, both are required for us to really be self-aware, but they're not related to each other, which I was kind of surprised by. I always thought, you know, if somebody kind of knows who they are from the inside, of course they would do the work and find out how they were seen on the outside and vice versa. But we discovered that they are, you sort of have to think about them as independent skill sets within the self-awareness area.
In the work I do, I've started realizing the value of speaking to people beyond the immediate work colleagues. The question I often ask them is, how 360 is your 360? Let's now get back to Dan Cable.
I wanted to pick up on one of the things you said, right? You spoke about transience aversion. In the book, you also talk about eulogy delay. as two things that come in the way of us leveraging the power of this. Could you talk to us a little bit about the eulogy delay piece?
Absolutely. The eulogy delay. So what a eulogy is that thing that we seem to do. Lots of cultures do it, actually, where you wait till somebody dies and then you say what you appreciate about them. And usually that's a very somber moment. There's a lot of tears and they can't hear you, ironically. And that's ironic. That's interesting that we, not every culture, but most cultures kind of wait until the people can't hear you to say that. And that delay reveals something interesting about our society, you know, that we don't feel comfortable. Or another way to say it is we have made it uncomfortable to share that. And what my research is showing is that people are very reluctant for that reason to do the highlight reel. You know, I do it in all my classes and I've done it. I guess we've done that for 14,000 people now. You know, it's something that I know quite a lot about. And I can tell you that most people on the front end just have that aversion. They have that sort of like, oh, that's weird. And guess what? It is. It's strange. We don't do it. But that doesn't make it wrong. And so, you know, I think that you have to want it bad. You're not going to randomly do a highlight reel because it involves stepping outside your comfort zone and asking people for their memories of you. So, I mean, I hope that the listeners would give it a go, but just to reinforce it, if you don't want to read the book, there is a lot of science suggesting, and I mean like University of Chicago, published in one of our best journals, Psychological Science, showing that not only do the letter writers enjoy writing that, meaning their heart gets bigger and they feel a lot of warmth and love while they're writing those memories, but there's research that shows that it improves your own life and it improves the relationship. And so, you know, after all this research, and I mean, I've done, I guess, 6 studies on this now, but there's probably 20 studies out there now. There's no downside other than that weird awkwardness. And, you know, Deepak, I liken it to an optical illusion where when you look at an optical illusion, you often see that like straight lines look wavy. And then you hold up a ruler to them and they're straight. They're parallel. They're complete. But your mind fools you into thinking they're not straight. And that's what happens with this stuff is like, because we have these sort of cultural oddities, you know, these cultural decisions we've made, it feels like it's going to be really weird to ask. And that's just too much. But then after 14,000 people have done it, like 97% of them. And I mean, literally almost every person says, I just wish I'd asked more people. I just wish I'd done this earlier in my life. You know, I can't believe we're not doing this as a species. And you have to be on that side of it. You have to hold up the ruler. You have to check the science to see that that's an optical illusion that's holding me back from my potential.
Fascinating. And in the book, in a related context, you talk about the power of visualization as well.
Yeah.
Right. And you refer to the golfer Jack Nicklaus. And you sort of say that he was able to recreate a successful experience in his mind before he played a shot. Talk to us a little bit about the parallel you see between a sportsman or a sportsperson, rather, sort of using the power of visualization to deliver that perfect shot versus, you know, us using the highlight reel to visualize the best self.
There's two important ideas here. So the first really important idea is our brain gets stronger when we practice. And that, you know, that's just the notion of neuroplasticity, which at this point I think is a fact. You know, in the book, I try to go through some of it, but it appears, for example, that when taxi drivers in London have to get the knowledge, their actual physical brain changes to allow that to allow that many streets to get into their brain.
Wow.
and that's just really interesting. And it's powerful. And it's really important that we remember that the brain is just a muscle. And sometimes it doesn't seem like that. But the fact is the brain is just a muscle. And when you use it, it gets stronger. So that's a really important point. So you asked me a really good question, which is to kind of talk about the similarities and the differences between visualization and the highlight reel. Okay, so let's talk about how it's different and how it's the same. One way that it clearly is different is, unlike athletes, we don't usually actually create films of our best moves. You know, we're not able to look at that perfect golf swing or that perfect kick where the ball just went into the net and over the goalie's head. So what we have to rely on instead are people's memories of how we made them feel, how we solved a problem, you know, what unique value we brought to the party. So that's one really important difference, because that means we're dealing more with memories and words and less with, you know, video recordings. I think that's worth putting out there. But I know that's a big difference. But a big similarity is trying to make yourself at your best salient. Like, so I recently did one of these podcasts with a coach who worked with gold medalists and silver medalists at Olympic levels. He worked with some of the premier athletes in the world. And he says, what's so interesting is when we're on the outside of that, we look at those as the gold standard and we think, oh, they must be so confident. He said, in reality, they suffer an imposter syndrome just like we do, because they too get there and think, I don't belong here. I'm not this good. I'm going to blow it. And what they do is they have to make salient the times that they were that good. They have to really bring forward in their brain, almost as a confidence boost and also as a way of practicing, this is what you're capable of. So it allows them to access that more immediately, more readily. And so actually, wow, that's really an exciting point actually for me. We've just got to the most important element. This isn't wishful thinking. This isn't hoping of what I might achieve one day if I just wish hard. This is saying there have been times in my life when I have created an exceptional impact on other people. The question is, how can I get there more often? It's not saying I'm 24 hours a day. It doesn't even say 7 days a week. It's just saying I am capable of that impact. I know it because these 20 people have written me memories of times I've done that for them. I can do that more often with intentionality. And I think right there, there's so many more things I could say about it, of course, but I actually think that right there should help even the okay, when I was a cynic, that's one of the reasons why. I thought it was just wishful thinking. And what I've come to learn is the neuroplasticity of the brain says what leaps into your brain about who you are. And if we can train the brain to dish up memories of what you're capable of, you're more likely to do that more often.
Fascinating. I want to link it to one of the things that I discussed with a fellow London Business School faculty member, Herminia Ibarra. She talks about this notion of liminality when it comes to our identity, especially when we are in transitions. Can you talk a little bit about how we could take advantage of the highlights reel to help us get a better grip on our identity or identities, if you will? Any nuance there?
The first thing I want to do is I want to point out, I'm going to call it an area of confusion for me, but then I'll point to where I think my own research and my own teaching is going. Okay. Herminia talks about this authenticity paradox, which is a beautiful concept that she's known for, which is a lot of times when we start doing something new, it feels awkward and like it's not authentic. And then that holds us back from becoming great. It holds us back from changing into a bigger, better, more impactful identity because we're handcuffed to what we used to be. Now, when we talk about playing to our strengths, and you know, I've had good discussions with Herminia about this, what sometimes people think is, oh, well, playing to your strengths just means like kind of mailing it in, like almost hanging out with what you're already good at. And therefore, you know, you kind of like holding yourself back. And what I'm talking about is stretching into your strengths. What I'm really interested in when you talk about the liminality. So the liminality idea would be neither betwixt or between. For a little while, we have to just play. We aren't our new person yet. We have to play our way into that. And the way I'm thinking about that is thinking hard about what unique strengths we have to make an impact, and then asking the question, how can I grow that impact? How can I use the strengths and the abilities that I have to make an even bigger effect on the world, a more positive impact on other people? And I have to tell you, that's what drags us positively into new strengths. See, in my own opinion, when we play to our strengths, it's energizing. Our strengths strengthen us. When we use our strengths, we feel strengthened. And so that's quite, it gives you a resilience and it makes you robust. And so when we can say playing to our strengths in a new area, it doesn't go perfect at first, but it's energizing to try. Whereas when we try to shore up our limitations and kind of improve what we're not good at, it actually can be very detracting. It can even burn people out if you do it sort of too much. If you're over-focused on your weaknesses and trying to become average, it actually can wear us out year in and year out. And so I think that in that long-winded answer I tried to give there are these little nuggets of not continuing to do exactly the behavior you've done in the past, but to use your strengths to improve your impact. I think that that's sort of my best answer forward on this issue. But I'm really happy for you to challenge, or you know, even just like downright disagree or push, because this is an area that I would still say it has some elements of confusion for me.
You clearly have spent a lot more time studying this than I have. But the way I see it, Dan, I think strengths are a little bit around what domain, the what are the situations where you make an impact. Mm-hmm. Identity is a little bit of a who am I kind of a plane. So I was wondering if this exercise of the highlights reel can throw light on the who am I plane, especially a lot of my work is with leaders around midlife, right? Now, of course, we are moving away from the midlife to the anytime life crisis, given the paradigm of careers these days. But that's where I was coming from. But you're right, there's no clean answer. I guess what I take away from you is the highlights reel tells us where we are distinctive in terms of when we use our strengths to make a big difference to the people around us, and then we play with it to discover who we are and move forward possibly. Does that make sense?
Things, it does. And some of the things are right in between there too. And that's where I'm really happy to allow the confusion, you know, because life isn't clear and identity definitely is not clear. And I think that these are very cloudy concepts in some ways. Easy maybe for an academic to define, but maybe not always so easy to see it as a differentiation in real life. So one thing that's really, I'll just say whatever words we use, I'm not sure, but I will say one thing that I've been really happy to do for people when we create these highlight reels is certain things jump off the page to people and they capture people in almost an emotional way, beyond the words, beyond the concepts, beyond the sort of the cognitive consideration, almost like that makes my heart sing, or seeing that I've had that impact on those people calls to me. Or when I think back to those moments, it makes me feel more alive. And, you know, I think that we are very complex machines, us humans. And sometimes as an academic, I can tend to be overcognitive, but when I work with people that are actually trying to make improvements in their world using the highlight reel things, let me give you an example, you know, because to really show you what I mean, there was somebody, and I mentioned this person in the book, there's somebody that got their highlight reel. And in all of the stories from family members and friends and uncles and friends from high school, curiosity and this sort of natural, insatiable asking why came up. And they loved it about this person. And he was always inventing things and playing and like trying to figure things out and being curious. But none of his work colleagues brought that up at all. They mentioned like punctual and efficient and this. And so it's really interesting. He started thinking more about why he doesn't bring that to work. And why doesn't he bring his curiosity to work? And you know, he talked about how he's now a partner in a consulting firm and so on. He starts meetings really abruptly and he looks to get, you know, very efficient. And his life got so crowded that efficiency became his major watchword. But really, since he was a kid, he has been one of these sort of curious investigatory minds. So what he started doing after, you know, kind of realizing that he wasn't bringing the best part of himself to work, he just started playing with that self. Like, you know, he started, for example, in a meeting, instead of just diving right in and being on the agenda, he would start by asking some question of somebody in there that he was just genuinely curious about. It might be like, what movie you've seen recently, or did you hear about this new news about, you know, blockchain or whatever it might be, just to be curious. And or if he was meeting with a client, so he was trying to, like, you know, meet with a you know, CEO of a firm. Just being more curious about like the industry and what is the person seeing that's hot and what's not, but just being curious rather than like work for efficiency kind of thing. And he said, well, number one, he said the meeting started going a lot better, that he enjoyed them more. Yes. But like other people seemed to enjoy them more too. And they just seem more useful. It felt like the work became more giving, but also people liked him more. People enjoyed him as a human. Well, I don't know if it's because he was more authentic or because he was just being more curious and inquisitive. But the bottom line is, a year later, things were going better for him and he was much happier. And it's just one of those things where he'd gotten into his head a narrative that curiosity had no place in his job as a partner of the big consulting firm and, you know, numbers, 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 revenue, sales, you know, and... You know, I don't know if I'm even making sense to you right now, because I just wanted to tell that story to kind of reveal that as we reach these different career transitions, sometimes a good strong dose of this is who you are when your heart's singing, and this is who you grew up being. You know, this is what you've been as a cohesive person since you were a boy or a girl, you know. So I don't know. I don't know if that is useful to you, or if that's even what you wanted me. Anyway, ask more questions if I can make it more clear.
It makes a lot of sense, Dan. I hear you, and I do think there are cues hidden in the way we live some of our other domains, right? In terms of how we are with our children or how we are with our friends, and bring some of what makes us come alive from one domain, take that to another domain. So I think in a way, this also, what you're saying also reinforces the interconnectedness of things, right? I think as I do my research in this field, I'm realizing the value of just the interconnectedness of things, right? Who we are as a parent, as a son, as a spouse, as a colleague. It's just that you know, it's all one interconnected whole. So to your point, I do think there's a great opportunity for us to bring our best selves from one domain and bring that to bear in other domains as well. Point very well taken. In the book, you also use the term emotional labor at some point. I think you refer to Seth Godin, who speaks about this as well. And you actually say it takes more energy to hide parts of ourselves than to live authentically. I found that quote quite provoking. And you also say that activating our best selves with a highlight reel increases our resilience against both social stress and sickness. Could you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah. Emotional labor is the idea of having to hide what's natural, what feelings are happening naturally. So a really crass example is if you were a flight attendant and one of the passengers grabbed you in a sexual way, they're sort of trained to hide that disgust and that dismay and to obviously be firm, but still be positive and pleasant. And that's very wearing. Now, that may be a business necessity, but it's very wearing. And that's a very harsh example. A less harsh example is if we feel like we have to hide who we are at work, you know, let's say curiosity, and just wear the mask, as some people call it. That isn't actively hiding, say, disgust, but it is in a day out basis, kind of sanding down our natural selves in order to become somebody that we're not really. And that can wear us out. You know, that causes emotional labor, causes sickness because of, you know, energy consumption. It makes us less good at our jobs. Like another example of that, by the way, again, these are harsh examples, but it's worth putting them out there. There's a lot of research showing that stereotype threat causes people to do a lot worse because it, like, say you go to Stanford University and you're going to be an electronics engineer in a class, and your name is whatever, Joanne, and you're one woman in a class of 72 men. Maybe there's one other woman in there, but it's a classic. There's more people named John than there are women, that kind of thing. There's this thing called stereotype threat where you start to become worried of how you're being judged. And that worry becomes a form of emotional labor where you have to kind of show them what you're capable of, but you're so consumed with showing them that you're not able to actually perform as well. So there's really good research on if you can make those people feel better about themselves and their strengths, if you can affirm who they are at their best, they're able to bring more of their thinking to the table because they can be less worried. They can be less anxious. And so there's study after study showing that self-affirmation allows us to overcome that stereotype threat. Now, so anyway, there's a whole lot of research on that concept. Your second question, though, takes us in a slightly different direction, and one that I think maybe I know even more about because I'm not really a stereotype threat researcher, although I love that domain. The thing that I have been intrigued by, and again, intrigued doesn't mean that I know everything about it, but it does mean I've read an awful lot about it. Somehow, some way, when we are highlighting what we are at our best, it seems to activate this part of our brain, this ventral striatum. And in the book, I have a book called Alive at Work. I call that the seeking system, after a neuroscientist named Jak Panksepp. He called it the seeking system. There's something about highlighting our unique skills, our unique values, like what makes us unique as an individual, that seems to charge up this part of the brain and delivers a hit of dopamine, you know, which is literally like an energizing neuro. It's a chemical in our brain. It's a neurotransmitter. And that's not only energizing, meaning it's like a free drug that gives us energy. It does seem to reduce anxiety and help us deal with stress. Another way to say that is it seems to kind of tamp that down a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that's really powerful and interesting. And I think important in one of the studies, and right now this is at a revise and resubmit at a journal, we found that by giving people these highlight reels and then stressing them out, they were not only more able to deal with the stress. And I can tell you a lot more about the specific study if you'd like, if you think the listeners would like to hear more. But they were not, so once you stress them out, they were not only able to perform better, be more creative, solve more problems, but they also, we had them expectorate into a cup, which is basically spit into a cup. And then we assayed that for their ability to fight disease, their immunity. And we found that it not only caused them to perform better, but it caused them to be more immune to disease. That's really powerful physical results that our body does for us when we highlight and are made aware of what we're capable of. Now, again, lots of confusion. It's not as though this is final and I'm positive that this is the way it works, but we have replicated it twice now. And there is really good evidence suggesting that something happens in our brains when we highlight what's unique and best about ourselves.
Got it. And bringing it to day-to-day life in the corporate world, Dan, anything we can learn about the art of giving good constructive feedback from the work you've done?
Absolutely.
Clearly, as a manager, you need to communicate strengths in the context of a role. You need to communicate development areas.
Yeah.
In the context of your research around underscoring highlights and positives, what's been your reflection around what it takes to land good feedback?
Yeah, and I love that last question you just asked is what I wanted to start with. The first bit of advice, which is, it's so clear, it has to do with negative and positive feedback, but it's the specific memory, the specific nature of memory. If you tell somebody, for example, you're really good with kids, that's a nice thing to say. Or you're very good with details. That's pleasant. That's a really nice thing to say. It isn't particularly sticky, and it's not particularly energizing. It's not particularly emotional. It doesn't really help me relive a moment, an experience. It doesn't help my brain light up with what it is that I do best. And the visceral, emotional nature of our brain is that it loves stories. It loves a beginning, a middle, and an end. It expects that. It remembers that. That's what it's sort of like, it's responding to that. So I have this way of saying it, which is catch somebody doing something right and then help them relive it. It means that if somebody, a friend, a family member, but also a colleague, a boss, somebody that you work with, does something really helpful, really useful, jot down a couple of the things that, like, number one, it's the beginning. Here was the context. This is where we found ourselves. In the middle, here's what you did. Here's what you brought to the party. Here's what you did that was unique. And then an end. Here's how you helped us. Here's how you made me feel. Okay. If you jot that down, just a paragraph, it might take you 5 minutes. It at maximum would take you 15 minutes. But jotting it down and really playing through the details and trying to help them relive it, that's what's going to have that astounding impact. And then even, in my opinion, the idea of writing it down, not just saying, good job, you know, that was really good work with that detail, but instead taking the time to record the memory with specificity, it speaks volumes that you're noticing them and that you're giving them this gift of a specific memory when they excelled and they really added value. That's gonna light them up. Now, it's exactly the same with the negative feedback, but the fact is that's where most of us live, is all the good stuff, we just kind of let go and we assume it, including with our partners, including with our children. We tend to like let all the good stuff become assumed, and then we focus on the couple of things that didn't go well, letting the 98% swish by. But if you need to give negative feedback, I think you know this. The literature is very clear that you don't say you need a little more help with your specificity. You know, you're not always on the ball. You know, these types of vague, almost incoherent sentences, they frustrate people, but they don't seem to help people very much. And what you really want to do is say, when we had that client meeting and you spoke up in this way and then you kind of went on too long, the effect that had was to actually push the client away and sort of turn them off and tune them out. And here's how it made us feel as a firm. You know, you made us seem like we were irrelevant. But the idea of, again, articulating specific details in a story, in a memory, is, I almost can't give any better advice than that. So I think that's probably the second thing that I do want to say, though. And again, I'll stop because I don't want to just go on and on here. The second thing that I can say in terms of like giving really good feedback is to remember the emotion of gratitude, especially in organizational life. We just don't seem to use gratitude very much. In my podcast recently, I did this study. We covered this study around headwinds and tailwinds. And the headwinds in life are like when you're riding your bike or you're running, and the wind is blowing in your face and it's kind of feeling like it's holding you back and it's really obvious and salient to you. And so we tend to focus on that. Like, what's the problem in my life? The tailwinds in life are the things that are going well and they're just kind of pushing us forward. Just don't notice them because it just makes everything a little easier. And we forget to have gratitude for the tailwinds and we focus a lot on the headwinds. And I think this is why in real life organizations, we spend so much time on people's limitations and mess ups, which tends to, you know, kind of shut them down. And so, you know, that's a threat emotion that we're causing there. Now, I'm not saying that people don't need good feedback. And when they mess something up, they have to take responsibility for it. But we kind of forget to be grateful for the good things that they do. And that's a very energizing emotion. You know, gratitude is a very positive emotion that lights people up and it causes reciprocity. So, yeah, those are the things that I would say. I'm positive I could go on and on about those, but I think that those are the two things I wanted to say.
Got it. And maybe just a different frame as a father to two young children, 11 and 7. I was also reflecting on this notion of highlights reel as being something powerful as a gift that I could give my children as they grow older, because I get to see them do things and observe things that they might forget by the time they are old. So any reflections as a parent, you know, how can we leverage the work you've done around the highlight reel as helping our children discover and activate their best self?
Mm-hmm. That's really good. I mean, I've tried a couple of different things. It's not like I have a study on this, but I've tried a couple of things in my own life where my kids are 14 and 18. And just last winter, so that's only 4 months ago, I created my own stories, 4 stories for each of them about specific ways I've seen them acting that are unique, that are valuable in this world, that I think will really serve them well. And I did write those out. And I would say, just speaking practically in my own experience, the 18-year-old really responded well. She gave it a lot of thought. She'd also written some for me. So that was a really nice sharing moment. She's going away to university in the fall. So as you're saying, that almost became a collection of sorts. For better or for worse, you know, everybody's their own way. I don't think the 14-year-old really was in the place to respond to it. You know, speaking of identity, she's trying to form her own identity, and that might mean moving away from us a little bit right now. That could be part of it. But it's not that I in any way wish I hadn't done it. It was a wonderful exercise for me, and it actually made me feel really warm. So talking about my 14-year-old daughter, I would say it was just sort of a pleasant thank you, Daddy, but less of the sort of emotional I'll remember this for a long time. It had a big dent on me, if that makes sense.
Dan, in the book, you speak about the fact that we could collect the highlight reel elements from various people, but you actually suggest that we read them as a big bang rather than a drip feed, if I may paraphrase your suggestion.
Yep.
And you suggest that we wait for 10-plus stories to accumulate before we really process them. That's sort of suggestion number one. The other thing you also say is that we choose the right time and place and allow the stories to breathe rather than skim over them. Can you talk a little bit about how we should process the highlight reel once we collect them?
Yes. The waiting for the stories to collect, that to me is really important because we want to have this emotional jolt. In my opinion, a long way back in our conversation, we talked about what cancer did for me, and it created this jolt. It jolted my life. It was traumatic. And that trauma, while I wouldn't wish it on anybody, it was important because it causes us to question our normal assumptions. And that is what this highlight reel can do for people. It is traumatizing, but in a positive way. It causes many people to cry. It unleashes a lot of emotions that you don't even really know where they're coming from. They're mostly positive, but they are a bit stunning. If you get one story or maybe two in a week, and then you sort of read them as they're coming in and maybe just like open up on your email while you're doing other things, really, that may not have its maximum impact. And you may even kind of tune out. Like some people, before I understood all this and would give people this advice, they would read them as they came dribbling in, and they would kind of do it like on the bus or on the tube on the way home. And, you know, you're not going to really allow your emotions out on the tube. You're not really going to, even if you got a very powerful and emotional thing, you're not going to like let tears roll down. But to read and really get the biggest jolt on this, you really want to give a space where, you know, for me, say you had 25, 30 stories, you'd want to leave an hour to let that kind of soak in and take your time. You know, it's a real gift. This isn't something you probably have ever read before. And these are some of the most important people in your lives. And they've taken real time to commit stories to paper. And you really want to just give it the space it deserves. So if anybody out there who's listening is going to try this, I actually would wait until you had all the stories in, even if it was just going to be 5-10 stories, get them all, you know, hold out, and then wait until you can give it space and quiet and you can experience the emotions. And then what we do in my classes, in my courses, I have them read it the night before, but then they bring it in and then we start to debrief what it means and how it can help them and how they would craft their jobs or their lives around these strengths. But yeah, I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because part of what this book is good for, in my opinion, this exceptional book, some of it is to expose these ideas, these evidence-based ideas to people, but some of it's very practical. You know, each one of us can get a little more living out of life. And so this point you're bringing up right now is just a really practical point of like, how do you get the most out of your highlight reel?
And the other thing you suggest, which once again intrigued me, was you say that you try and use your art to represent the story that resonates with us the most. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, what's the benefit of doing that?
Yeah. I'm going to say that there's a couple of different things. First one is, it's not art itself so much as using different parts of our brain to work on a concept helps our brain remember that concept. So, for example, speaking about it is different from reading about it, and reading about it is different from drawing it. And they all can reveal something different that helps our brain process it deeper and deeper. So that's, I think that's one really important thing. A second thing is, I'm not an expert in what I'm going to say now, but art seems to use a part of our brain that doesn't need words. So it's going to be hard for me to talk about this, but it appears in the science that when we draw, and I don't even mean in a way that is literal. I don't mean like you draw an event, like here's the person holding the ball as the child threw it. I mean more like it might be a splash of color on the page that this is how this story made me feel. Or it might be a bunch of shapes that you made out of clay that here's how that day made me feel. But what using art seems to allow us to do is express our emotions and almost unconscious ideas that our words just don't do justice to. So let me give you a specific thing that I do. And by the way, I'm not saying that this is for everybody. I'm saying that different people also learn in different ways. But in my own class here, I have a class on sort of creating change in our own lives and in our organizations. What I do is I have them read their best self report the night before. I help them debrief it in the morning. And then in the afternoon, I bring in an artist who works with them. For instance, he'll have them illustrate with pastels the way that one of the stories made them feel. And then he'll have them use, let's say, clay to have another story. And then they'll introduce those stories. They'll pair off and they'll introduce, this is what this story meant, and here's what this splash of color meant, or here's what this shape meant. And that not only allows them to articulate something in a different way, it gives them a way to talk about it with people.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. This insight from Dan reminds me of my conversation with Jennifer Goldman-Wetzler, a conflict management expert, who speaks about the notion of engaging our emotions while speaking to others. In our conversation, she alludes to the great "I Have a Dream" speech by Martin Luther King. And she actually goes on to say that one of the reasons it's such a great speech is because it engages all our senses.
And the best way that I know how to engage our imagination is to make it really concrete, actually, by using our five senses plus our emotions to imagine what the future could be like. And if you watch Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, it is unbelievable the way that he uses language to help us imagine the future that he wants for us by using the senses of sight, sound, touch. He talks about the valleys and the mountaintops. He talks about quicksand, and then hearing the ringing bells of freedom. So you can feel that quicksand that you might be sinking into, but then you can hear those bells of freedom ringing. And so that imagery, that's such a great concrete example that he provides for us of what we can do for ourselves. So I encourage us all to be our own Martin Luther King Jr. and imagine, what would it look like then? What would it sound like then? What would it feel like then? So for example, I've had clients say to me, you know, I can imagine going out for dinner with this person who I work with, who I've been in serious conflict with, and I can smell the wine that we would be drinking, and I can taste the food, and I can smell it coming out of the kitchen from the restaurant that we're going to be in, and I can really imagine the good feelings that I will have from connecting with this person in a different way than we have been over the last many months.
At a very personal level, I took the plunge to move from a corporate career to what I do now around February 2016. A few months later, I think around September or October 2016, the movie MS Dhoni released. This was played by Sushant Singh Rajput, who's no longer with us anymore. Over the weekend, I learned the guitar, and I was learning the chords of the song Besabriya from the movie MS Dhoni. And I listened to the words. Kya ye ujale, kya ye andhere, dono ke aage hai manzar tere, kyun roshni tu bahar talashe, teri mashale hai andar tere. क्यों ढूंढना पैरों के निशान जाए वही ले जाए जहां मेरे सबरिया बेसबरिया बेसबरिया Sabriya. And so on. Now just that line, Kyun roshni tu bahar talashe, teri mashale andar tere, touched a part of my heart that words hadn't. Sorry to break into a little bit of Hindi and Bollywood, but for people that don't understand Hindi, it basically means, why are you looking for a light from outside to guide you? Why don't you listen to the fire that's burning inside you so strongly? Maybe it was the stage of my life, but there's something so powerful about art and how it touches you. I guess this song is even more poignant today, given Sushant Singh Rajput is not with us anymore. But in the context of this particular podcast, if I link it back to what Dan is saying, Teri Mashale Andar Tere is a bit like activating your best self based on insights from your past. Let's now get back to the conversation with Dan Cable.
Deepak, have you ever heard of Lego Serious Play?
Not really.
You might think about Lego.
My son is a big fan of Lego, but I'm not aware of Serious Play.
Exactly. Well, so Lego is something we usually associate with kids and play, which it is. But it also is something that we're now using in leadership courses and in training to allow people to build their thoughts. Because when you build a three-dimensional thought, you then can hold it up and show people and describe it. It becomes a prop that pulls ideas and concepts out of ourselves. So there's a whole literature on that, by the way. But yeah.
Wow. Lego Serious Play, is it?
That's right. That's right. I have a book called Alive at Work, and I have a whole chapter dedicated to that because it's becoming science. It's one of these really fun ideas that there's now really good research on, and it's showing that it makes our brain work differently and better to be playful and tactile with our ideas.
Since you mentioned it, do you want to just maybe spend a minute or two on it? How do we use Lego just to... in the context of leadership development.
Okay.
Just maybe expand on that.
I'll even go one step farther. In the context of career transitions, which I work with, we have a program here called the Sloans, and it's a one-year MBA kind of program for very senior folks that are like going into a new direction in their careers. We have them work on who they were in their last job. And we literally have a session with Legos where, you know, there'll be little people and there'll be hoses and there'll be building blocks and windows and doors and trees. And we'll just say, okay, pick 25 pieces and then assemble them in a way that shows us who you are in your job today. And we'll give them 25 minutes to do that. And then we'll say, okay, now grab 25 more pieces and draw what you are going to move toward. In 15 years from now, if everything worked out perfectly, who would you be? What would you be doing? What would be your role? And so then we have them do that 25 minutes. And then what we do is we put those two together and we say, now describe to somebody what it meant and what it will be. And boy, the room just lights up because like the hose that they use to represent feeling strangled or the prison. They built a block and they put a little person in it and said, this is me. I feel like I'm in a prison. And it just becomes animated and emotional. And by pointing at it, by turning it, it reveals things that they meant to say, but like they wouldn't have said it unless it was there. They'll put a skeleton there and say, this is how I usually feel today. And then on the other one, they'll sort of build a person out of vibrant colors and say, this is what I want to feel like. And boy, does it just becomes really fun instead of static. It becomes enjoyable and dynamic instead of kind of, oh, I don't know, overly cognitive. So anyway, I'll stop going on about it. But it does appear there's some really interesting science that when we allow our hands to build our ideas, we end up in a different and sometimes better place than when we just rely on a verbal medium.
Fascinating.
We have so much to learn, Deepak. It's one of the things that thrills me. I think I want to say that out loud. I love remembering that we don't really know that much about our brains and our emotions. You know, even in physics, in the physical world, we've only known about gravity for 400 years. So we've only started learning about our brains in the 1980s. You know, we didn't know about behavioral plasticity really until the 90s. So... I love to remember that what we don't know is much bigger than what we know.
Absolutely. And another reason why I do this podcast is, you know, A, it gives me an opportunity to talk to people like you and learn from what you've learned. But the other thing I find fascinating is I come in thinking I'll learn ABCD, but I end up learning ABCD and then some EFGH, which is totally different.
I love it. Yes.
So I came in to learn about exceptional and I walked away learning not just about exceptional, but Lego Serious Play, which was completely in my blind spot, right? Which is the beauty of these conversations.
That's right.
Lovely. And as we sort of come towards the end of the podcast conversation, Dan, you also talk about the risk of probably overusing our strengths if we don't apply it thoughtfully. So can you talk a little bit about what are the watchouts in the context of the highlight reels and strengths
What are some of the things that we should bear in mind so that we don't tip over to the wrong side?
That's right. This is another one where I'm really glad you're bringing it up, because practically speaking, there is a concept called Achilles heel, which is another way to say overused strengths. It's another way of saying that your strengths become a weakness if you overdo them. And I have tried to think about this so much because I never would want to lead people astray, and I'd never want them to stop being humble about how much they have to grow. And I'd also never want anyone to think that they're perfect. You know, we're all flawed and we're all going to die flawed. It's really more about how do we discover the way to do the best part of ourselves more often. And so in terms of this Achilles heel and overplaying our strengths, I'll give you a specific example that I wrote about in the book. In my own self, one of the things that I can do really well is kind of be an extrovert that forms quick relationships. And I guess apparently good at like quick vulnerability, where I'll say very true things, humbling things about myself, which allow people to open up around me, frankly, to kind of feel comfortable and psychologically safe. So as an extrovert, I get a buzz from that. I go around. So that works great in a classroom setting. It doesn't work great when I'm out on a date with my partner and I end up spending 10 minutes talking to the bartender, another 4 minutes talking to somebody that seems interesting on the way back, and then maybe a 10 minutes talking to a waiter. And I'm intrigued. I'm all lit up. I think that this is exciting and interesting, but I'm getting dopamine release and I'm self-expressing and it's all very exciting. But it's not what that date was for. So the way that I'm phrasing it these days is to think about the impact that you're trying to create with your strengths. And that's going to vary a lot depending on the context. And if you're not careful, overusing your strengths actually can get in your own way, you know? But if you're careful, and if you're thoughtful, and if you're intelligent about playing your strengths, you can't really do them too much. The way Marcus Buckingham put it is, you'd never want to turn down your strengths. You'd want to turn up your strengths, but use them intelligently. And so that's something where I'm always working on that myself. I think maybe we all are, but it's just that space of both staying humble and also that space of using it to create the impact that you seek, not using it for using its sake. Does that make sense to you, by the way? Am I expressing that clearly?
Makes a lot of sense, Dan. The way I interpret it is for us to be aware, right? Not to just sort of blindly turn it up all the time, but to your point, be aware of where we are and the outcomes we are trying to drive. Yes. And ensure that we are thoughtful about the application and the contextual, the context in which we applied. So that's the way I interpret it.
That's right. And it's really interesting to think about how, like going back to my own thing and just being honest with myself, even in the situation of like, say, going out with my partner versus going out with some friends, it can even be the same literal setting. Let's call it a pub in London. But if the impact that I want to make with my partner is, let me use my strengths with her, I might play up my natural curiosity and sort of entertain her with a story that I heard that day and maybe a piece of science that I read that I'm intrigued by. And that is playing to my strengths. Whereas if I'm with five friends and they're having a good time, then it may be perfectly fine for me to talk to the bartender and light up their world a little bit. And then on the way back, talk to a wait staff and just kind of light them up a little bit, because that's not only playing to my strengths, but it's giving me that dopamine rush. And it's a certain awareness and a certain intelligence of using that. I find that really interesting and practical. So I'm actually really glad you brought it up, even to allow me to relive it again.
Lovely. Dan, this podcast is called Play to Potential. Given your journey, your life, your lived experiences, your research, if you had to sort of leave the listeners with a couple of things that occur to you when I say the phrase play to potential. What comes top of mind?
Yeah, the two. I absolutely love how you would end it with that, by the way. It's the things we already talked about, but I'll just highlight them. The transience aversion and the eulogy delay. I'd say those are, transience aversion is remember to keep death close to you. I really believe the monks and the ascetics, I believe they used to keep a skull on their desk. And the idea would be, I'm close to death. And by remembering that, it reminds us to play hard, you know, to really try to do what we're capable of doing today and not just put it off for a day and then a week and then a month and then a decade. So I think that's number one. And I think the number two is that if we catch people doing something right and alert them to their impact, we not only build better relationships, so they like us better and they feel they can trust us more and they feel closer to us, but then they feel this norm of reciprocity where they'll do that back to you. And I feel like if we can get beyond these sort of these barriers, these natural resistances, we can be, that's one of the ways of becoming exceptional. You know, we really can become somebody that highlights people's strengths and builds better relationships and does it today, you know, rather than kind of blending into the woodwork, which is actually a place that some of us end up being if we're not careful.
Lovely. On that note, Dan, true privilege talking to you, and really enjoyed the energy that you brought to the conversation, not to mention the insights. So thank you so much for your time.
Great. It was my pleasure. Thanks for taking the time with me too.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. If you found the podcast purposeful, do take a moment and contribute to Antarang Foundation. I work closely with them and can vouch for their impact with young adults who come from challenging backgrounds. While we are battling the health crisis, we cannot afford to ignore the issue of solving for livelihoods in our battle to save lives. The second COVID wave has further worsened the employment crisis in India, and supporting an organization like Antarang can mean a lot in these challenging times. You can get more details at the paid forward section at playtopotential.com. Do also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise out there given the boom in the podcast supply in India in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers because they often care about these metrics. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. To receive a bite-sized nugget every 3-4 days from the podcast archives, do send a WhatsApp message to +91 85914 52129 stating interested. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Thank you, and hope to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.